Welcome to the Airplane Geeks Podcast. This is episode 127 of the show where we talk aviation. I'm Max Flight, and with me today are two co-hosts. First, Rob Mark from Jetwine.com is back from the Middle East Business Aviation Show in Dubai. Hi, Rob.
Hi, folks. Boy, it's nice to be back. Boy, is that ever a long ride back from Dubai.
It is kind of a, yeah. So how was the how was the experience?
You mean of the ride in the back?
Yeah.
I tweeted quite a bit about my experience. I'm too much of an airplane geek. I'm kind of short on patience when it comes to flying in the back seat of the airliners, and I was not disappointed on this trip.
How about security? Did you experience any?
Oh my goodness, was that ever interesting? I'll tell you this real quickly. When we got to Dubai, you know, you have to clear customs. I had to run my carry-on bags through a scanner before I could even talk to the customs guy to get into the country.
Huh, that's interesting.
And then when I picked up my bag at baggage claim, I had to run it through an X-ray again before I could get out into the terminal. So they're just, wow.
Can't be
too
careful.
A lot of security checks.
Yeah.
A lot of security checks.
All right, well, we're glad you're back.
So am I.
Also with us is Dan Webb from the Things in the Sky blog. Hi, Dan.
Hey, good evening, everyone. And hello to all the listeners, whatever good, whatever time of day it is, I guess. Sorry, I lost my train of thought.
That's
Dan, we've only been on the air 30 seconds. How could you lose your train of thought already?
Well, we had 16 minutes of pre-show, so that's my excuse.
Luckily, the people don't hear that.
Our usual third co-host, David Vanderhoof, won't be joining us since he's had a major security disaster. It seems his Gmail account was hacked, and he's trying to put his online life back together. So his blog and his podcast are gone, but hopefully he can get that sorted out. So good luck to David with that.
Yeah, and in case the hacker's a Geeks listener, could David have his accounts back, please?
Yeah, please give David his accounts back. Our guest this episode is Captain Steve Fulton. When he was a pilot at Alaska Airlines, Steve helped develop the world's first required navigation performance procedure, and he was a principal author of the RNP RNAV criteria in the FAA advisory circular on this topic. Steve is now a technical fellow with GE Aviation. He's co-founder of formerly Navaris, now GE PBN Services. Steve, thanks for taking the time to join us on the show.
Thank you, Max. Glad to join you and Rob and Dan. Looking forward to a good time.
Absolutely. Steve, after the news, we're going to get into RNP in detail and talk about what it means for the airline industry and for the environment. But before that, maybe you can give us just a very brief definition of that.
Okay. So what we're doing with RNP is we're in a transition from a world where we had primarily ground-based navigation. We're transitioned to an aircraft-based navigation system. And what that does is frees us from an older world where it was more about the rules, the standards, the specifications, and now we're able to unleash the performance, the full performance of individual aircraft and couple them with operational applications. So there's a lot of opportunity, as you said. We'll talk about that.
Sounds great. Can't wait. Very good. All right. Coming up, we're going to talk about a bit of the aviation news from the past week, and then we'll move on to our conversation with Steve on RNP. We also have Steve and Grant's Australia Desk Report, and Peter Johnson has come through with another Across the Pond segment. We've also got some listener voicemails and emails to go through, so we're looking forward to that. All right, first, though, the week's aviation news. Our first story comes from USA Today. This is verdict in Concorde crash called chilling. You know, it's been 10 years, hard to believe, since the crash of the Concorde. And most recently, there's been a court case concerning that. USA Today says a French court found Continental Airlines and one of its mechanics guilty of manslaughter in the 10-year-old crash of a supersonic Concorde jet. And this, of course, was the event where the Concorde struck a metal strip on the runway that had come off of a Continental jet ahead of it and sort of precipitated the chain of events that led to that tragic crash. So it's very interesting that this has been sort of a criminal case. I think oftentimes, or more often, aviation accidents are not treated as criminal acts. And Steve, I think as a former airline pilot, does this give you cause for concern?
Well, certainly it does. A lot of what we've done in the cockpit over the years is transition from more operational concerns to more, legal concerns. How's this going to look in court, or what could I be held liable for? And you get another dimension going in your thoughts, and it certainly is distracting when maybe that mental energy could be applied in a different way. But after an event, what this does is begin to have people behave differently than you would like to have
right.
in an investigation to understand, what really happened. And so as this trend is becoming more more typical, certainly outside the United States and maybe some of the parts of the Western world, or I should say some of the, we're seeing it in Europe right now,
yes.
in France, and it's really troubling. And certainly there's been people who've gone to jail. I remember there was an accident in Milan where a Citation crossed the paths. What was that? An MD-80, MD-83, SAS. Mm. And there was an accident there. And you remember the controllers ended up in jail there. And so this type of thing really is a bad trend.
It reminds me also of the crash in, was it Brazil?
Yeah, exactly. There's another example.
Yeah.
So you got the Legacy Business Jet and the Gol 737 that, for reasons yet to be finally determined, they were at the same altitude, the same point in space.
Right.
And then you have this collision, and unfortunately one airplane was lost with all souls on board. And immediately the surviving pilots of the other aircraft are essentially on house arrest, and it's a criminal investigation from that point on.
I think the part of the article that troubled me the most was according to some of the experts that the article quotes. The article says, quote, European criminal prosecutors have seized evidence from accident scenes, preventing government accident investigations from determining what happened, unquote. So if they're doing that, it says they're doing that in some cases, I guess my concern is, I feel that the primary goal of the accident investigation is to see what happened so we can prevent this from happening again.
Right.
So if a criminal investigation is preventing that learning from happening, that's a little bit concerning to me.
I think that's a lot concerning. Yeah, I really agree with you. This is not the first time, as we said earlier, that we've seen this, and this is always an ugly trend when someone is more concerned about who they can point the finger at than in figuring out how to prevent it from happening again.
Yeah, I think in a lot of these cases, these are exactly what we call them, accidents. I mean, obviously, if you're dealing with a plane going down an act of terrorism, that's a completely different ballpark, but. In these cases, there's really no. It's an accident.
Yeah, what this does is it changes the behaviors of people in finding out what really happened, so we can improve safety. But it also impedes change, innovation.
Right.
I think about my own case, which we'll talk more about later. But I introduced in the '90s a significant change in how instrument operations will be conducted in the future, and. It's a good change. It's an important change, but it had never been done before. And in that world of moving from what is known to the unknown, even though all of the technical pieces are well cared for, if there is a problem, if there is something that develops, you have nothing to stand on if somebody wanted to charge, make a criminal charge, other than just a technical story. So, this is the thing that we have to think about, too, is aviation has always been about innovation. And if we start seeing this type of thing, we could begin to see ourselves becoming more stagnant than
right.
maybe some would even say we are today. We want to see more innovation, not less.
Is there any forum that's could appropriately deal with this issue? I mean, are we just left to, complain that it's not a good trend? Is there... is there some organization out there that, or some body that can address this issue effectively, do you think?
Well, I think the Pilots Union, the International Pilots Union, is having their voice. ICAO, Flight Safety Foundation. There's a number of entities that are doing, you know, what they can as far as what channels they have to communicate the concerns. But ultimately, these get down to local state, state meaning country decisions.
Right, yeah.
And just the culture and the legal processes within. And unfortunately, they may be more immune to that industry voice. Now, if it came through, ICAO is a United Nations construct, but if it came through a more of a international legal entity, mm-hmm. that could somehow have some effect, some voice into that local situation. But I think that's going to be really hard. The best thing is through kind of the peer pressure of the international community that, like some of the categorization of countries with their regulations and safety standards, perhaps you end up with a little bit of a black mark in your peer group of other countries, and perhaps that will have some effect. Hmm. But it's indirect, certainly, yeah. It seems.
Yeah, but you know what's scary about that whole thing, though, is that it, and I agree with you, Steve, I think that's certainly something worth looking at, but if you were the pilot involved or part of a crew that was involved in something like that, and they came after you for negligence, I mean, you might end up in jail while someone else sort of fights on your behalf, but you really become a horrible scapegoat. And look at this crazy thing with the Continental airplane. I mean, did anybody actually ever figure out what that piece of metal was or what it was from? I don't know that I ever heard myself.
There was at least one story that I saw that suggested that it was a titanium part, but that suggested that it was an unapproved part.
And yeah, but we don't know from what. Or was that the concept that it was the reason it failed or came off is that it was unapproved?
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Oh, okay. Yeah. I just want. Yeah.
On a much less important note, is someone going in a bag of chips right now?
Do you hear chip noises?
I heard a bag noise.
Oh. did it sound like this?
Yes.
Oh, Rob's at it again.
Don't blame me. I'm sorry. You know what? I was so excited to be home. I stole a bag of M&Ms out of the fridge here in the office, and somebody left, and I was eating them. Sorry.
So we've had an episode entitled Rob's Jelly Beans, and we can now go to Rob's M&Ms.
Oh, let's not. Okay.
They used to scold me constantly for this, Steve, years ago. I've really tried to work on this problem.
And you've been doing so well until now.
Well, you know, it's being married to that shrink. See, she's been able to help me over my anxiety of withdrawal of whatever it is I was eating.
Okay, let's move on to our next story. This comes from BNet, Brett Snyder, Southwest's performance problem, how to fix those late arrivals. And the DOT, the U.S. Department of Transportation, issued its October airline statistics, and that showed that there were no three-hour tarmac delays. But at Southwest, their on-time performance has slipped, and Southwest is saying, well, it's because we have full flights. And they're going to have to rethink how they schedule. But, you know, before we get to that, you know, back to the point that there were no three-hour tarmac delays, I'm wondering if this isn't a result of the legislation that imposes fines for lengthy tarmac delays. Isn't that the real reason that we've seen an improvement?
I think part of it was weather, because there have been some studies and I mean, weather is what drives us the most. I haven't had a chance to really dive into the data. I think definitely the ban is a big factor as well, because, you know, airlines are planning for this because they don't want to be slammed with a big fine from the DOT, because I believe the maximum fine is up to $27,500 per passenger.
Yeah, per passenger. That adds up pretty fast when you've got a reasonably full aircraft.
Yeah, absolutely. So if you're an airline and you think, you know, I could get fined and I don't know what that fine is, it's probably just makes more economic sense to cancel. But I think just because weather was good for the month overall, I think that was a bigger part. Actually, if anyone's interested in studying this more, there's a website that's been up for a few months, but they just released a second study, tarmaclimits.com. And one of the guys who's author of the study is Daryl Jenkins, who we had on a few months ago.
Oh, yeah.
And the study is really interesting, and they have some analysis of the results, you know, like the effect on cancellations. Could any improvements been made? Be made with the system? So I definitely recommend that if anyone's who's interested to take a look. But over to Southwest, I mean, this was very interesting because Southwest has typically been good in this area, and they really went down towards the bottom this month.
Yeah, second from the bottom, right, according to this article. They were at 77.5%. That's for arrivals within 15 minutes of schedule times, whereas the average for all airlines was 83.8%.
Right. So, and part of it is, you know, higher load factors, though Southwest, while they've really improved their load factor over the past couple of years, which has really helped their revenue performance, still lower than some of their competitors. But also, one reason cited from Southwest in Brett's article is that they've been scheduling more and more connecting itineraries. And Southwest has always said, you know, we're a point-to-point carrier. But over the past couple of years, they've been scheduling more and more connecting activities. I mean, they've avoided the word hub. But, right. I mean, cities like Chicago, Midway, and Baltimore have become more and more important connecting points in their network. Recently, so Southwest said, quote, recent load factors during the month contributed to our decisions to delay aircraft and hold for customers who we wouldn't have been able to accommodate if we canceled flights. So, you know, holding flights, I mean, if you're the, and this is something I've heard about anecdotally, if you're a passenger and, you know, you're trying to make your connection, if the airline holds the flight for you, of course, you're going to be really happy. But how does everyone else in the plane feel? And plus, that's going to knock down your on-time percentage. So I think this is one issue that Southwest is going to have to deal with. I mean, if you're doing something with a 20-minute turn, which they've, well, granted, which has expanded, but that was very instrumental in their early days. If you're big on fast turn times, well, if you're building up more connecting itineraries, you know, what adjustments have to be made? So this will be interesting to see how they work on this over the next few months.
Yeah, but I don't think most people sitting in the back, having recently sat on a BA airplane at Heathrow, waiting for almost 4 hours to be de-iced last week, I wouldn't mind sitting somewhere for 15 or 20 minutes, knowing that a whole bunch of people are going to be able to make the flight and not have to sit in the terminal somewhere. I don't find that a big imposition, and I grant you that, you know, the numbers on the on-timer are important to some extent, but when you talk about this kind of an issue of convenience to passengers that screws up the record, I'd say, you know, screw the record. I mean, if the people are all happy,
yeah,
who cares?
Who makes that call? Is it the captain?
Oh, no, that's no. Probably the dispatch people, yeah. I would think.
I would agree with Rob. I mean, if I'm have to sit for 15, 20 minutes, not a big deal. But I mean, eventually, especially if it's a delay, and I'm guessing that for some of these canceled flights, complete guess on my part, this could be, you know, last flight of the day. But if you're holding a flight middle of the day that ripples through the rest of that aircraft schedule, you are going to inconvenience a bunch of people.
Steve, have you ever been in a situation where, you know, you've wanted to do one thing, either, you know, wait or move on, and you're sort of at the whim of the dispatchers?
Yeah, it's usually not the dispatcher. Because the captain and the dispatcher are jointly responsible for the decisions for the flight. But there's a higher authority, and every airline has a different name for it, but there's going to be a director of flight control airline operations center, AOC. Somebody in that organization is tasked, or a handful of people are tasked with looking after the operation and making decisions from a system viewpoint, not an individual aircraft viewpoint. And so as you have a simpler operation, a captain can see something and make a call on the field, what I want to do and what I think is best. But as the complexity of an operation, of an airline's operation increases, it's more and more difficult for that call to be perhaps the right call or the best call for the overall system. So early on at Alaska Airlines, we had a lot of authority and autonomy as captains. We could make calls, particularly up in the Alaska network, the state of Alaska network. And that's still true in a lot of ways, in that particular area, which is a less and less percentage of the flying for Alaska Airlines. But as the Alaska Airlines operation has increased in complexity, we've seen that change in that job, even in Alaska. Mm-hmm. You know, I just want to say something about this this on-time performance metric.
Yes,
I think it's something you have to really be careful with. I think perhaps sometimes too much attention can be given to this than what maybe is deserved. And I'll explain this by just using an example here. And I'll just say every airline can have perfect on-time performance.
Mm-hmm.
And imagine a flight that takes an hour between city A and city B, and the worst case ever, it might go to an hour and 23 minutes. So if you schedule every flight for an hour and 30 minutes, you're going to have near 100% on time performance.
Right.
But if your flights 95% of them or 90% of them are coming in somewhere around an hour or an hour five, you've got a lot of wasted time where that airplane is set into the gate before you can use it for the next departure. And so this is a dial that the airlines have on their control board where you're always having to adjust what is our scheduled block time. And if you've got a situation like I suspect that there is right now at Southwest, and we see hints of this in some of the quotes that we hear from Southwest, where you understand that they're going through some changes. You know, their routes, their networks are in transition. Their style of flying, their type of flying is changing. You know, they're having to tweak this dial and try to get it at the right point. But what we've seen in this industry over the last decade or two is that all of the block times between a given city pair are creeping up. So we're sitting in the airplanes as passengers longer, even though the flight may be on time, or we're on an airplane or on board an airline's airplane that has a very good on-time performance record. What they've made a decision to do is to invest in on-time performance so they don't show up on the radar with the DOT statistics, but
yes.
It comes at a cost.
Right, sure.
They're paying for a capital investment that they're not getting a lot of efficiency out of. So Southwest is like every airline trying to play with this dial, and they're in and out of, the statistics, in the lineup.
Sure.
And it's a question about efficiency versus, dependability. What is the product you're representing to the public? And at the end of the day, it's still a discouraging downward trend in on-time performance. I mean, in terms of not on-time performance, it's discouraging downward trend in terms of our transportation systems performance. You know, if you look at... maybe you've heard some of these statistics. A flight between Washington, D.C. and New York, in a DC-3 back in the 30s, maybe that flight might have been done in a certain number of minutes. I don't have the numbers right now, but it's going to be some number that there's been some studies published where even as the jets got introduced, it's like maybe double what a DC-3 flight might have been. Now with a jet, just because our complexity of our airspace has gotten to the point and we're not managing it.
That's amazing. Wow.
So anyway, I see stories like this about Southwest, and I just have this other kind of feeling that, we're it's a single dimension metric that I think sometimes there's a lot of noise made about. But what we really should all be caring about is an efficient airspace operation that keeps all of us in these seats the minimum time. We want to depart the gate on time. We want to arrive on time and have those times in between, the elapsed time, be as short as possible.
I agree with Steve. I guess the only couple things I'd add is while block times have increased, and you have to wonder, well, is an airline improving its on-time performance because, okay, well, maybe its employees are doing a better job or maybe they're just playing with the schedule. I guess it comes down to the fact for me is a block time is sort of like what the airline promises to you.
Yes, and, you're absolutely
and,
right.
And in the sense that, so Southwest on time was a little bit below 80, so roughly one of every five flights I take, it's going to be not what was promised. I mean, if you look at that, like, I mean, maybe it's not fair to really compare industries, but I guess if another service industry where one every five times you didn't get what you were promised, you'd be pretty angry. That being said, I also agree with the airspace. Making our whole national airspace system more efficient. And it is interesting, Steve, because I think it meshes nicely with you being on the show, because Southwest has been putting a lot of investment into R&P over the past couple of years.
Okay, let's push on to one more news story. This is from the Tehran Times. Boy, when was the last time we had a news article from the Tehran Times? This is plane makers eye Persian Gulf buyers for luxury jets. So this article mentions that jet makers, Bombardier, Embraer, even Airbus, are looking to the Middle East as a region where high-end business travel is sort of more accepted, and hopefully that will lead to kind of a rebound in that segment. Rob, you were there. What did you find at the show? Is this rebounding?
Well, I think the show at MIBA, which is the Middle East Business Aviation Show, was very different from, say, the NBAA show, for people that may have some knowledge of that. It was much smaller. It was much less busy. But the folks that were there tell me that the people that were there were interested people. And so that was a good sign. But I did an interview with Trevor Eisling, who's the VP of International Sales for Cessna, and they essentially believe that the Middle East is where the recovery for business aviation is really going to begin. Many people have said that it was going to be in China, but that market is still too slow for what we need. Cessna is still delivering airplanes to companies in Egypt. Egypt is a large market for them. Also to Saudi Arabia, into some of the other aspects, into Bahrain. And so, from what we heard, there is light at the end of the tunnel there. And the operators, there were some orders announced at in Dubai last week. For Bombardier.
Yes, yeah.
And so, people generally came away saying, listen, this was, considering the state of the economy, it was pretty good. Of course, we have to be realistic in the sense that the economy never tanked in the Middle East the way it did over here in the US or in Europe.
Mm, yeah.
So their climb is not from such a low point as ours was, but it's been pretty steady, and it's still steady. It's still growing. It was interesting on the ramp at the show. Everywhere you looked, you saw big airplanes. I mean, there must have been six BBJs on the ramp sitting in front of the show.
Wow.
And ACJs, Airbus BBJs, and all kinds of other big machines, which for a business show, usually they're just an odd one here and there. This place was covered with them, so they like big machinery out there.
Yeah, I can see.
Yeah, a 737 is a regional jet by that definition.
Yeah, exactly. Of course, they are finding medium size airplanes. Going back to the Cessna folks, I mean the Cessna Sovereign, an 8-passenger jet. I mean that. The medium-sized jets on the Challenger side and the Falcon side have all done fairly well there in the Middle East. The light jet market, it's just not there, and I'm not sure if it's going to happen in our lifetime or not, because people just don't seem. That's a luxury area. I mean, when the hotel I was staying at in Dubai, there was a rental car lot right next door to it, and when there's a rental car lot, you see all the cars that are usually there waiting to go. And on this lot, there were nothing but there were Bentleys, there were Audis, there were big black Mercedes limousines, BMWs. I mean, that was their rental car fleet. And these were all luxury cars, because that's all anybody wants over there.
Yeah. Was there a particularly fond moment from the show that you have? Something that you came away with?
Let's see. I think that was prior to the time I got sick.
yeah, no doubt.
No, actually, I don't know. It was an interesting place. I guess I was really surprised at how much traffic there was in Dubai. I mean,
you mean like cars?
Every morning, the traffic out to the airport and back.
Oh,
from
it's
the
bad.
Airport, bumper really to bumper.
Bad. Yeah,
I mean, just unbelievable. I was really surprised, and we never did figure out where all those cars were going. We just know they were in front of us, between where we were and where we were trying to go to. But it was still an interesting show. Interesting show.
You plan the time of day that you want to go anywhere there for sure.
Yeah, and of course I wasn't driving, but and of course the exchange of money took a little time to get used to, because you have the UAE, the dirham, and I had no idea when I exchanged them what they were worth. And so when someone says that you know, dinner is going to cost you 200 dirham, you go, holy smokes, till you find it that really only, you know, $50 or whatever it was. I don't know, but so it was a little more expensive. But one thing that was interesting, bottled water. Now, you would have thought they're in the middle of the desert, yeah, and I would have thought that that would have been at an absolute premium.
Yeah, the
you
precious
buy
commodity.
A liter bottle of water for about 30 cents over there.
Wow. Huh.
And I didn't understand. I don't know where it was coming from, but...
Again, our guest this episode is Captain Steve Fulton. Steve, I looked up RNP, and of course, when you look up things, almost always you end up at Wikipedia. And Steve, you're in Wikipedia. When you were with Alaska Airlines, what got you interested in this topic?
Well, I came from a technical background. Before I went to Alaska, I'd studied engineering at Georgia Tech, and then flew immediately out of Georgia Tech, flew for ASA, got some good flying experience, flying the Bonerana in the shorts. Hmm. But after that, I went to Honeywell for 4 years and had a really good understanding of avionics technology when I was there in Phoenix. And in, after 4 years, came to Alaska. And I came there because Alaska has this culture of using technology to address or to improve operations. And there's a number of firsts that airline has in their history. Hand-flown Cat 3 approaches with the HUD on the 727. That's where it all started, was at that airline. Millimeter wave radar approaches with the C-130 on the North Slope. And so we had a situation in Southeast Alaska where it was a handful. You know, we flew these airplanes like a Navajo. You had localizer, VOR approaches, circling approaches, offset localizer, which is the LDA, all these variety of approaches that took a lot of training, and even with the training, just because of the limitations with the nav aid and the weather and the terrain, we would get in places where you just couldn't get in. We'd often have multiple missed approaches. You'd go over to some other airport, land, get gas, come back, and sometimes you're just flat out scared. We were in places where you're, you know, missed approach points 4 miles from the end of the runway, and at nighttime, you got everything in sight, the lights out there, and you start descending towards the runway on the VASIs or PAPI, and then everything goes out because you've flown into a little stratus layer that you couldn't see. You're kind of looking through a hole diagonally.
Wow.
And now you're below the MDA, you're inside the missed approach point, and what do? We had what we call the Pratt & Whitney missed approach, which was on the 737-200, just max power, and you're climbing to go back where you came from.
Oh, man.
So the situation here was we knew we could do better. I had this understanding of technology. I knew at that time that GPS was just emerging in the early 90s, and there was a performance capability in the airplane that had exceeded what the operating rules for airplanes had been previous to that point in terms of instrument approach, procedure design criteria, and the crew procedures and the systems on the airplane weren't being used properly.
So what is the technology that this employs?
It's primarily a well, actually, let me just break it down to four components.
Okay.
We're taking a combination of systems on the airplane to fly a defined path from takeoff to landing. And to be able to do this properly with RMP, you need to have some sort of ability to fix your position. And this day and age, it's GPS. But GPS has some vulnerabilities. And so in our high-end airplanes, we have the opportunity with inertial reference systems ring laser gyros to complement the GPS and have a very good position solution. And then that position solution goes into a navigation computer. We call it different names, a flight management computer, flight management system. But it's a system that's taking in this position input. It's defining the path, both laterally and vertically, and doing it in complex ways. So a modern FMS can use straight segments in combination with very precise curved segments that are a radius around a point that we can define. And so you can use multiple combinations of straight, curve to thread an airplane in some pretty interesting ways that are all within the limits of the bank and turn performance of the airplane.
Sure. Right.
And then vertically, of course, we can define a very complicated path of the path computer. So the next thing that we have to do is we have to display that picture to the flight crew. It doesn't do any good to create a complex path we want the airplane to fly if the flight crew don't have some understanding of what this intended path is.
Right.
And so we have to have a nav display, some sort of a map display that gives us the information to be aware of what we're doing with the airplane. And then finally, the piece is some sort of flight guidance system that can follow that path. Now, you may be doing it manually, or you might be using the autopilot, but either way, you got to have some way of following that trajectory. So those four pieces are what's required on the airplane side.
Is it a dynamic process?
Right now, it's not.
Okay.
What we're doing is we're defining these trajectories, these flight paths in advance. There's quite a bit of engineering that we're looking at, a number of factors. We're looking at what the constraints might be. They could be, the obvious ones, of course, are mountains we had in Juneau, which is where all this started in 1996. We started flying the first of these approaches in Juneau. But it could be airspace constraints. It could be places where we don't want to fly airplanes, maybe over noise-sensitive areas, and so forth. So we take into consideration the constraints. We want to know what path the airplane performance might be suited for. And most importantly, we look at, after those two are satisfied, we look at where can we save costs? Where can we reduce fuel burn, reduce emissions, and so forth? And so all of these are factors that go into the process of defining this trajectory in advance, and then it becomes a published route, which goes into the charts, and it goes into the navigation database and is pulled up as a set of points on demand as you're flying the airplane. So we're not to the point yet where we're in some sort of dynamic exchange where these routes are being created on the fly. Probably for the next few decades, it's all going to be in the terminal environment, defined in advance trajectories.
Can you quantify the savings at all?
If we're looking at a typical narrow-body operation, domestic operation in the United States, quite a bit of work in Australia, so it's the same there, anywhere between 5 and 15% of the fuel burn could be reduced.
Wow, that's huge.
It's huge, and this is exactly why GE Aviation is involved in this. You look at what it takes in terms of technology to get that type of an efficiency improvement in an airplane. In fact, a number of companies are building more efficient airplanes, more efficient engines, and you know the materials, the technology are becoming more and more exotic, expensive.
Right. Sure.
And then you put these wonderful machines into an airspace that has this type of inefficiency, and you realize, here's an opportunity to create value, to improve an operation for the benefit of the market. And this is the direction that GE is going.
Is this part of next-gen ATC, or is this something separate? Or
It's the core of next-gen.
It's the core of next-gen. Okay.
Yeah, and when you bring up the term next-gen, you know, what does that mean?
Yes.
And it is really interesting. As a matter of fact, I've really begun to realize here just recently. We get inside of our technical groups and our cloistered communities, all of us working on this, and we talk in our own language. It's no different than any other community of special interests. It's easy to get inclusive and forget, or not inclusive, but to get inward looking and not understand how to communicate outside of that tight little group, that community, and it's no different for us. So when we talk about NextGen as an aviation community, you know, there's some general objectives that everybody can identify with and resonate with, but what is it? What is NextGen? Is a great question that you could raise in the midst of maybe a congressional subcommittee that's working on how to appropriate funds to the FAA to build this thing. There's all kinds of different interpretations there within the FAA. You'll find, I mean, the FAA is a large organization with lots of different people. You know, having a message that's concise, that's focused, that everybody gets is a real challenge right now in this whole effort around NextGen. So I'll just throw it out to you guys. I'm just curious, just for fun, Max, Rob, Dan, what is NextGen? In as far as you know, let's see where that goes. That might be a little bit of a presumptuous thing for me to ask.
No,
but I'm
not at all.
I think here's my guess. So far, it seems that NextGen is this mystical black hole for my tax dollars that hasn't done anything yet.
Wait a minute, Dan, do you have tax dollars?
I do. I'm gainfully employed. So at times.
Okay.
So yes. Ouch. Really.
Well, you know,
I mean, I have ads on the blog. It actually works.
Yeah. Good.
So.
All right. So a black hole where your tax dollars are going, Dan. Nothing more than that.
Well, no. I just see so much potential in NextGen, but I guess what's frustrating me is just granted, I haven't been around a long time, but I remember like 5 years ago reading articles about how we're going to see these eminent changes in the way airspace is designed and controlled. And it just seems that I don't know what's really going on because I haven't been tracking as much. It just seems that the FAA has been talking about improving the way we design our national airspace for years and years with not a whole lot to show for it.
It does seem painfully slow. I mean, that's, you know, to me, NextGen has been about efficiency, about airspace efficiency.
It's kind of an oxymoron, isn't it, almost, that it's about efficiency, but somehow
it
seems to be run so much by the government, who's not terribly efficient.
I mean, obviously, RNP has had great deployments at Alaska, obviously, operationally, and Southwest has been putting a lot of money into it. The only reason I keep mentioning them is because I was able to interview the guy, one of the head guys on the project at Oshkosh, so I've been following that. But it just seems that on an overall level, that there's just a lot left to be done.
Well, yeah, if you asked about definitions too, and Steve, mine I think is, while it's not a big black tax hole, because I tend to vote Democratic, and of course we know that there's no end to the amount of money we can spend, so we don't worry about that kind of thing. seriously, I'm just doing that to rub my friend Dan. But you know, it's funny. I have a picture of a magazine cover from a story I wrote in the Chicago Tribune in 19. I'm looking at it here. It says 1988, and it was about gridlock in the sky. Too many planes, too few controllers, congested airspace. And I remember doing the interviews for that. 1988, listening to people saying, well, wait, 5 years from now, when we redo the air traffic system in this country, it's going to be astounding. And it's funny. I feel like it's one of those things that the closer we get, the further away they put the carrot. And while I think there certainly have been benefits for places like Alaska, I mean, they see real life examples of this working. For the rest of us, I don't know where it is in the process. I don't know, and honestly, I guess I don't know when it will ever be done. Is there an end point to it? I don't know. And I follow this stuff, and I don't even know where it is. So, you know, it's
Rob. You're in great company, Rob. The things that you just said are what I hear very often. I heard, I think it was Dan that was saying that the concerns that we have is, you know, right now it's the government leading this. We have to be honest, and I think this right up front. We have a very complex airspace operation in this country, and to change it, we also have to continue to operate while we're changing. We don't have the luxury of turning it all off making all the changes over time, and then and then flip the switch, right? So it's a it's been compared to changing the wheel on a car while you're still driving it, and that might even be and simple to describe it that way. So it's important work. It's got a lot of we've got a lot of opportunity to improve our operations. You know, the situation I was talking about earlier with the flight delays and the growth in block times. This all comes from a problem that we all recognize. The question is how to change it. And what we did in 2003 when we created Navris, which, as we mentioned earlier, has now been acquired by GE, right. We had this idea that that this was a place for a commercial company to come in alongside of the government resources and use our technology, use our commercial mindset, look at how we could introduce changes that would maintain the level of safety that can never be compromised, of course, but at the same time improve the overall operation. And so when I said a minute ago that RMP, or this idea of flying airplanes on paths, is the core of next gen, I'd like to take a minute and explain that.
Sure, go ahead.
Let me just begin by saying that I'll say something provocative here, that every aircraft flight has an intent, and it doesn't really matter. And there might be some exceptions. Sometimes we get in the you were talking earlier, one of the podcasts I was listening to earlier, somebody was operating a Champ. So if you got a Champ or a Cub or something, you jump in this. Sometimes you just go out just for the pure joy of flying around, maybe an ultralight or a powered parachute, just flying around in circles. But even something like a Saturday morning flight to the local airport to buy a hamburger or to go up to a training area and do some air maneuvers or some air work, every flight, particularly as we look at corporate flights and airline flights, you have some intent that you want to take off from some airport and you want to land at some airport. That's the business intent.
Right.
In next gen, we understand that we have to translate that intent into something that we can call a trajectory. Mm-hmm. And it's going to be a defined trajectory that sometimes we might be tempted to think it's just from takeoff to touchdown. But actually, we want to have a trajectory defined from the point we start the flight. For an airline, it would be the pushback from the gate all the way from taxi out, takeoff on the runway, a least cost route to touchdown, mm-hmm. and then taxi into the gate. Now, for next gen to work, those trajectories that every airplane has, that business intent, or in the language of SASAR, which of course is the parallel to NextGen. It's the European version that's being built, so it'd be complementary and parallel to our system. Mm-hmm. The language they use is the reference business trajectory. That intent, that reference business trajectory, is then communicated outside of that airplane, and it's looked at in the context of what everybody else wants to do. And it's probed, all of those trajectories are probed to determine if there's any potential conflicts. And those conflicts are resolved in advance. Where today we have a very tactical system where we have controllers making short-term trajectory changes with vectors. Here is a system that runs more like a railroad, where you have airplanes like trains on very precisely defined tracks. And you begin to run in and out of stations with a fourth dimension, which we don't use so much today, the time.
So it's look ahead.
It's look ahead, exactly. So you've got these trajectories that are looking ahead, and you begin to sequence and coordinate the operation on time. And so sometimes you'll hear this called a 4DT operation, four-dimensional trajectory operation. Mm. So we can't get to that future in one big step, as I said earlier.
Right, yeah.
So what we're doing right now with RMP is we're building in the terminal environments these trajectories that will be what you connect to with the en route segments. So we want to wire the airport so you have a path coming off of the runway up until you reach cruise altitude. And you want to have a defined path from top of descent or the vicinity of top of descent and takes you in an expeditious manner down to the touchdown. Hmm. So we started this work. Most of the work, by the way, has been done outside the United States. It's more advanced. And it's interesting with the Australia desk you have, these fellows would have a perspective about what's going on there in Australia because some of the leading work so far has been done in Australia.
Yeah, yeah. They keep telling us that we have to catch up to them.
Absolutely. They have done a very nice job. We started working there with Qantas in 2004. Mm-hmm. And they've gone across 17 airports now, and we're working on a national deployment with the intent that they'll have all 28 jet airports linked in this manner that I'm talking about.
But you know, talking about the Australia guys, that's a perfect example of what I feel like NextGen seems like to me. No matter how hard we work, those guys are always 14 hours ahead of us. No matter how fast we move, they always stay at that same relative distance away. I realize that there has been progress, and I don't mean to be flippant about it, but it just seems like there's no end.
It's a great place for us, though, to work cooperatively, and certainly GE has been there since 2004 with our company and in other activities. And the objective here is to get it's easy to do the RMP operations in Juneau. So this started in Juneau for us at Alaska Airlines, and by 1998, we had 7 airports and 27 RMP procedures throughout Southeast Alaska. Completely changed how we flew airplanes in Southeast Alaska. No more circling, no more uncertainty. It's a very connected network off of one runway, direct to another runway. Really nice operation. But it's difficult, and actually we had a harder time as we moved south of the state of Alaska. But we began working in Canada and across Australia, and in these places we've been able to move out of, in fact, only the very first one or two projects had anything to do with terrain. After that, it was all about efficiency. It's about using trajectories that were defined for the airplanes, lining up with where you're coming from and bringing the airplane down on the shortest path possible down to the runway. Think about how many times when we're landing, Rob, you've been flying as a corporate pilot and other things, I expect. So much of our operations in these jet environments, if you're coming from the west, let's say, and landing to the west, you'll fly past the airport, sometimes 20 miles, only so you can go out there into the approach gate and connect to an ILS and drive right back to the airport you just flew by. And it's a couple of reasons. It's the technology, the ground-based ILS technology, but it's also this controller technology of having airplanes separated manually with airplanes needing to be all lined up in this sequenced line with the in-trail spacing being manually maintained by a controller looking at that line of dots on the radar scope. We can bring airplanes in, as we've demonstrated in Brisbane, and since 2007 in Brisbane, we have, I would submit, the most advanced air traffic operation in the world, where you have about 1 in 5 of the airplanes flying a greatly truncated arrival. In this example that I described, coming from the west, landing to the west, actually it's a north-south runway there, so coming from the south, landing to the south, I'll just make it correct for that example. The Qantas 737 airplanes, which is where this started, will be descending and turning onto a very short final. They don't come wings level until they're 1.7 miles from the end of the runway. So their runway aligned wings level segment is quite short, not 20 miles.
Mm, big difference.
Yeah. So you can see when we start talking about that type of operation, the only way that works, by the way, is having all of these airplanes that are coming together at that point that's about a little less than 2 miles from the end of the runway. They're being merged, sequenced with the use of time. So that arrival sequence is set up some distance from the airport. So as the airplanes start their descent, they're allowed to fly these defined trajectories and merge on time. So we have the concepts, we have the understanding of what next gen will need to be, but it's a incremental step of bringing that learning that we have in places like Brisbane back into the United States. There are 600 airports in the United States that have traffic densities, both in terms of overall traffic and traffic in the peak levels that are Brisbane or less. And what that means is we know that we have the technology to bring the benefits of a Brisbane into the United States and to have that reduction in flying time, reduction in fuel burn, reduction in noise and emissions at 600 airports that handle 49% of the commercial traffic in the United States.
Interesting.
Now, Steve, I have a question for you. For the full benefits of RNP and next gen to be realized, I guess do all the airlines really need to be on board here? And I guess how will that be done and funded? Because I mean, you have a couple carriers like Alaska doing this on their own. But I mean, how do we get everyone on board? Or if like if there's only one airline at an airport that's operating RNP procedures, are they going to get the full benefits?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Dan. And we hear this a lot in the United States, that we can't do RNP or some of these more advanced operations because we don't have a sufficient number of airplanes in our airspace that are capable of these more advanced procedures. So when I described earlier these advanced FMS or these modern FMSs that can do curved segments, for a lot of airplanes with older FMSs, that's a functionality that may not be there. They construct the turns using a turn that's defined on the fly based on the angle of turn and the ground speed, not a defined radius that would come out of a database. So this is what we hear, that unless we have some number, and you'll hear 80-85% that are capable of doing the same type of maneuver, one of these high-performance maneuvers, we can't introduce it at all. We can't enjoy the benefits. As I mentioned earlier, 1 in 5 is actually a little bit less than that. It was 18% of the traffic in Brisbane were capable of the advanced procedures when that switch got flipped on in January of 2007. And the reason it works there is because all of the airplanes are on a trajectory that's been defined. So if you can't fly one of the high-performance short turns into the runway, you're on a basic RNAV track that takes you out and is a closed arrival that joins the ILS. So the lateral track is defined. It just happens to be a much longer, more inefficient track. But because the track is defined, the time can be defined. And with the time defined, now you can merge at that joint, that merge point close to the runway.
Oh, okay. But,
so the situation here, Dan, the reason why we aren't able to introduce these high-performance procedures right now is because we're looking at the world through our current lens, which is this high-variance operation. When I say high-variance, look at how the airplanes are all over. If you look at flight tracks, you've got airplanes all over because the trajectories are being adjusted on the fly through radar vectors. And because we're managing trajectories to get the time on the fly with a manual controller, you know, they're literally flying our airplanes through the radio communications. We're not able to introduce any variance in track performance in terms of a new procedure. Everybody has to do pretty much the same thing. But once you move towards a trajectory-based operation and have airplanes on these defined trajectories and allow them to fly them, as I used the analogy earlier, it's like a railroad station in Europe where you have airplanes coming in and out of the station precisely on time. We marvel as Americans going to European train stations or other places in the world where they have train stations. They run to the minute just on schedule, you know, just boom, boom, right on the schedule, in and out of the station. And the reason they do that is because they have to. They're sharing the rails and they're sharing the railways, the stations.
And you can set your watch to those times.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they're proud of the precision, but it only works with precision.
Yeah.
And the reason the time works is because they're all on rails. You know exactly what the trajectory is.
Yeah.
Okay, so Steve, maybe you can explain one thing here, because this is where I get somewhat confused. I mean, I think your point is well taken about the fact that 49% of the airports in the United States might well work for the next gen system. Of course, it's not completely funded yet. No one is sure who is going to pay to equip the aircraft, whether it's the corporate side or the airline side. And as you just said, you know, it's tough in some of these dense areas where controllers are sending airplanes in 60 different directions at once, and we can't stop the system to implement this. But how in the world do they see themselves? I mean, we talk about someday when this all comes together, you'll be able to do, you know, fill in the blank at LaGuardia and at Newark and at Kennedy and Atlanta. I mean, but how do they see us making that leap? What is the what's the hurdle that we need to surpass in order to get NextGen working at some of these busy hubs on the East Coast?
Let me start first, Rob, by modifying what you said at the beginning.
Well, I'm used to that. My wife does that all the time.
Okay, all right. So here I go. So
here you go.
What I said was there's 600 airports in the United States that have Brisbane level traffic, Brisbane traffic densities or less, and those airports handle 49% of the commercial traffic.
Oh, I see. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. And what I'm saying is that we know, because of places like Australia, we know that we have technology today that will address that problem. We have enough technology. We have enough understanding, know-how. We in the greater aviation community, we know how to do this. So the problem and the challenge is this. Actually, I said Dan. It was Rob who was speaking, right?
Yes.
Sorry about that. So Rob, the problem is this: that the pain that we all feel the pain is coming from places like LaGuardia. The majority of the delays in our airline systems come from relatively few number of airports. As a matter of fact, it's probably the 30, what's called the OEP, Operational Evaluation Plan, is how the FAA categorizes these airports. The 30 OEP airports, the largest, most important airports in the country, is the source of most of the delays in the country. And so that's where the pain is. That's where the public pressure is. That's where the FAA gets pushed or feels that compelling urge to go to first. And my advice has been to the FAA. I just was in on a NextGen advisory committee subcommittee. We just had our first meeting last week, Monday. Any audience, a whole group of us there that come from different parts of the aviation industry. We've been elected to come together and to help respond to some of the plans that the FAA has and to help provide some guidance through this process. My counsel, my concern is that we are perhaps trying to jump in to too deep of water before we've really learned how to swim. And it needs to start with places that we already know and begin to transition the different work groups. When I was a pilot at Alaska Airlines, the world that existed when I started there in the early 90s was a hand-flying operation of the airplane, in Southeast Alaska in particular. It's a seat of the pants. As a pilot, it was a fantastic job. Non-radar, yeah, cleared for the approach at cruise altitude. You know, if we don't hear from you in 35 minutes, we'll come looking for you, basically.
Great.
And so you felt like a real pilot. Your hands are on the stick and on the throttle, and you're looking out the window, and winds are gusty, and you're 400 feet at night over the Sitka Sound, making this final turn, making all these judgments off the seat of the pants. The world at Sitka today is much, much different. I leave cruise altitude, still with my approach clearance, and I'm flying a defined trajectory, and I'm letting the airplane fly it for me. The automation is hooked up. So I'm no longer hands-on. I've stepped back one level, and I'm letting the automation in the airplane fly this path. And by the way, this path is engineered using all of the best knowledge from all different sources, both local knowledge in the community as well as within our pilot corps. And I'm managing the system, not actively flying the airplane. And so all the different work groups in the system are going to go through a similar transition. And controllers will go through a similar transition where they're hands-on today with a microphone in one hand and looking at the scope and talking and all of this, you know, calculations, you know, real-time going on in the head, to one where we're letting the airplanes fly on these defined trajectories and managing the systems that operate that. But we can't start with controllers or other work groups, all the different stakeholders. We can't do that, I don't think, effectively in LaGuardia or New York airspace as a starting point. like we've demonstrated in other countries, we start in less complex airspace. Brisbane is, it's Dallas Love. It's San Diego. You know, it's an international airport with 20-some different international carriers, but it's not LaGuardia or New York airspace or Chicago or Atlanta. So we take those work groups through that transition. We learn some lessons. We get alignment of understanding. If you look at the next-gen documents now, you know, there's stacks and stacks of very technical information. It's difficult for us to understand as humans, what does that mean practically to me unless you've been part of and seen it rolled out in some way in advance. Mm. And so to answer your question, Rob, what we need to do, how do we get it started? My advice, my recommendation, the words that I'm speaking when I have the opportunity is let's be intentional and work up to the more complex. We know that the challenges at airports that are our busiest ultimately is going to be runway occupancy. It's about loading the runways to their maximum capacity. And to do that, we have human controllers doing an excellent job of sequencing airplanes very tightly behind one another with strict speed controls and getting minimum spacing to the extent that the regulations limit. And we're getting touchdown after touchdown and loading that runway at some pretty impressive flows. To do that with this automated system, which will allow us to be more efficient because we'll have continual descending arrivals, we need a much better timing mechanism than what we have today in our current generation arrival management tools.
Well, let me ask you one quick question, though. When you use Brisbane as your guinea pig, essentially, in that environment, tell me again how many of the aircraft are equipped to use the next gen equivalent air traffic system over there?
When it first started, it was 18% of the total traffic. And that was the 737-800, the NG operation for Qantas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have at the present time what the percentage is, but certainly the first 3 years, let's say 2.5 years, from January 2007 to, it might have been January this year. I don't have that right at the moment, but it's been relatively recently we've seen other airlines starting to come online. There's a number of airlines that are, as part of this larger effort, it's transitioned from a Qantas-led effort to one now where we, GE, are aligned with the airspace operator. Air Services Australia is the equivalent of the FAA air traffic system in Australia. And so ourselves and Air Services Australia are rolling this out so that it will be available for all operators. And in response to that, we're getting more and more interest and transition in addition to the original 737 traffic.
Are they struggling with the same equipment funding issues for aircraft that we are over here?
Well, this is one of the things that's a little bit disappointing, I'd have to say, as an American. As I travel around the world a lot, the business just this year, I've been 45 different international flights, lots of countries. And outside the United States, particularly in Asia, South America, Rob, you were talking earlier about the Middle East. There are large numbers of relatively new aircraft. The U.S. airline fleet is falling behind in terms of the percentage of new airplanes that we have. And that's just a function, I think, of the economic hardship that we've been through. And so there's a lot of airplanes in Australian airspace that are quite capable of the best performance that we're talking about here with RMP, you know, a tenth of a nautical mile performance laterally. And so it's not such a big issue there about equipage. What's interesting in this country when we start talking about equipage, the focus of my talk so far has been around navigation. I wanted to make it clear that navigation is the central component of next gen, this idea of having airplanes on trajectories. But it's by no means the only element. There's a change in communication and a change to surveillance. In surveillance, of course, we're transitioning from radar to ADS-B. And ADS-B right now is almost the entire preoccupation in terms of what equipment we need and so forth, because the ADS-B component of NextGen is running along quite nicely, and I expect it to be fully deployed and operational in 2013. On the ground side, the ground network will be fully in place. So to the extent that we get airplanes equipped with ADS-B equipment, you know, we'll have more and more benefit. So equipage in our country is a question not only of the ADS-B, but to a large extent, some of the navigation and systems and displays. It was mentioned earlier about Southwest Airlines. I think, Dan, you talked, you were saying you talked to some of the Southwest folks at Oshkosh. Southwest has made a significant investment, and a lot of that was to address some of their equipment issues that are part of their, you know, past business model, where they had the airplanes kept deliberately in a very simple configuration. Now they've made the decision to upgrade all those airplanes, and at some significant expense. But all of that, as any business would do, is not a cost. It's an investment against a business case. And the business case, we mentioned earlier, about 5 to 15% reduction in fuel burn. Imagine what that would mean for an airline like Southwest Airlines, who is spending somewhere on the order of, I don't know exactly what it is today, but let's just say it's $1 billion a year, the fuel bill. 5 to 15% reduction in fuel burn, that's a pretty significant number.
Yeah, sure is.
So they're in the position of having listened to the FAA and the commitment on the part of the FAA to roll out NextGen and said, okay, we get it. We're going to invest in your plan. And I would say that the FAA is in a situation now of having to deliver on that plan. And so we're back to earlier what we talked about in looking towards commercial resources, and it was the business premise. It was the founding premise of our business when we started in 2003, that there was a room and a place and a legitimate role for commercial companies to play, to come alongside the FAA and to help make this a reality.
It's interesting. It's very interesting.
This has been very fascinating, Steve. We really want to thank you for this. If folks want to learn more about RNP, some good sources, probably the Navaris.com site.
Yeah, so the website is still www.navaris, that's N-A-V-E-R-U-S.com. It's a really rich website.
Yeah, you got some good videos there too.
Yeah, good videos, just some really amazing work I've done. I just came in this morning from China. It's my 42nd trip to China. We've talked about Canada, Australia, a lot of really interesting work in South America, and China has just been a fascinating place to be. I've spent a lot of time there. And one of the videos we have on the website is a validation flight, operational validation flight we did in 2006, opening up an airport that is completely inaccessible except through RMP. When they built this airport, the central planning office in Beijing, picked all this out, using all their conventional criteria. And they bought the ILSs, the VORs, the DMEs, and all the different equipment. And they got this thing all wired up, and the flight ops guys inside of the regulatory authority, the flight standards division guys, went in there and tried to fly this thing and said, this is just not possible. There's so many, you're flying down one radial to join a localizer, to change to a heading, to join another localizer and intercept a glide path. And rightly so, they said, in so many words, hey, we're going to kill somebody. And so that airport stayed basically vacant. It was completed in January of that year, 2006. And I flew in there in a 757 in July of 2006, and that was the first wheel marks on the runway. So Here's a major airport built in western China. It had gates, it had fire trucks, has control tower. Nothing but the wind blowing across that ramp for 7 months. Amazing. Until we got in there with our validation flight. And then in September, we introduced and commenced passenger operations. And so that video is on the site. It's a really interesting demonstration of how the technology can be used in that type of application. That's one of the more graphic demonstrations of what these airplanes are capable of doing. But it's much more interesting and, I think, valuable to understand that instead of mountains, our greater opportunity is, Rob, you mentioned earlier, LaGuardia. You know how constrained that airspace is, where you got virtual canyons where you have to thread airplanes down through, where you've got Newark, Teterboro, JFK airspace restrictions. And just like in these canyons in China, we fly through the same airspace, through the same type of environment, but it's all virtual canyons there.
Amazing.
So we're happy to have people visit that site, and I expect it would be very helpful. The thing that also I'd like to communicate to people, too, is all of this work right now, at least the initial work, has been primarily air transport. And, you know, we're starting to see certainly the Gulfstream 6 or 550 and I think the 450 and some other airplanes are starting to come online with RMP qualifications. But in my view of the future, this is every bit as an opportunity for a general aviation airplane right down to, you know, a Cessna 172 or Cirrus or this type of airplane as an air transport airplane. The airport, I fly a Cirrus out of Renton Airport here, and the Renton Airport is very close to Boeing Field. As a matter of fact, the runways, center lines conflict with each other. The localizer for the north runway at Boeing Field crosses the center line relatively close to Renton. And so there's some restrictions, and then land in the south, you're coming over some of the most high-priced real estate, Mercer Island, that's around Seattle, and the noise and so forth over that. By being able to fly these curved paths, you open up opportunities for airports like Renton. And so general aviation operations can flourish and not begin to see these airports get more and more constrained and concerns about noise and types of things like this that we'll see in the future.
Interesting.
Get more and more impactful.
Great. All right, Steve, thanks again for joining us. It's been a real pleasure. I certainly learned an awful lot today.
Yeah, yeah, well, it's really nice talking to you guys.
This has to be one of our longest guest interviews in a while, Max.
I think so, but it's been really fascinating. This is,
and I still have more questions, but I think we're going to have to hold it.
Yeah, yeah. All right, Steve, again, thanks for joining us.
You're welcome, guys. So all the best, and look forward to listening to more of your podcast. I really have enjoyed what I've heard so far.
Oh, thank you.
Keep up the good work.
Thank you very much.
It's because you haven't heard yourself after we've edited.
Well, good luck. It's been open mic hour here, so hopefully it's not been the...
No, it's been great. Seriously, it's been really interesting. I have learned a lot as well, so I'm glad you came on.
Well, I'm a passionate person on this subject. I love avionics, and I like these types of applications.
Yeah, clearly.
I would never have known that.
You couldn't tell by the last hour?
No. Couldn't even tell, no. Hey, thanks for coming.
All the best. Take care.
Right, see ya.
See you, Steve.
The didgeridoo means it's time for the Australia News Desk. Here's two of the craziest guys we could find south of the equator. It's Steve Vischer and Grant McHaren from the Plain Crazy Down Under podcast.
Dateline, December 12th. 2010.
Well, g'day folks, and welcome back to the Australia Desk for episode 127 of the Airplane Geek Show. Steve Issue with you once again, and I'm shivering here. Grant, what's happened to the summer?
I don't know, mate. It's shot to crud, the weather lately. I haven't thrown a balloon into the sky in ages. We have been grounded with really crud weather, although it's starting to look like it might be coming right.
This is a conspiracy. You know, David Vanderhoof sent me an email the other day saying that it was about minus 15 Celsius or something in Philadelphia. I think they're trying to, you know, send us down some of this horrible cold weather just to spiders.
I think they've heard that the world on the whole has had one of the hottest years in record, and they're trying to send some cold our way just to kill the stats.
Yeah, well, works for me. I am always a skeptic, as you know.
I know. I don't know what's causing it, but I do know that the temperatures are rising.
Yeah, where are you now, Al Gore? Anyway, speaking of things that make lots of pollution, the...
Oh, our favourite subject, aircraft.
Aircraft, that's exactly right. The RAAF's Super Hornets have officially come online.
That's right. The king is dead. Long live the king.
Hooray!
Hooray! That's right. The not long after the F-111s were officially retired and sent off for museum pieces or scrap heap, the RAAF declared that the Rhinos had hit their initial operational capability target as another four arrived.
Yeah, now these aircraft are going to number one squadron, part of number 82 wing. That's based up there at Amberley. We've spoken a lot about Embley lately, but that's where they're going.
That's where the action is right now.
Absolutely. And the boss of the base there is Wing Commander Glenn Brez, and he says, yeah, they've got 15 of them now on stream, and that's enough for them to commence operations if we need them. I know that doesn't sound like a lot of aircraft in terms of the United States Air Force, but, well, our Air Force isn't that big, folks. So, yeah, 15 jets is a lot, and that's cost the taxpayers lots and lots of money. So it's great to see them in the air. You know, Grant, we're up there at Amberley. I tell you what, there's a lot of houses in very close proximity to Amberley, and, boy, you know, I'm considering moving up there. Imagine listening to that noise every day.
Yeah, well, for us it's not noise, but for some it is, and there's a big concern going around about the F-35, if it ever gets here, and there's a lot of indications that the F-35 is going to be a noisy little bugger, and people living in close proximity to the various bases it will be located at are getting rather concerned.
Now, the idea of the F-35 is that they will basically replace every other strike aircraft in the fleet. Well, actually, at the moment, that's only F-18s.
I'm sorry, mate. I have to say it. Yeah, right. I'll believe it when it comes out.
Well, I'm just reading what it says here on the screen, Grant. But, yeah, that's the idea. So not only would they be at Amberley, but they'd also be at Tyndall up in the Northern Territory and Richmond, of course, down there in New South Wales. So they're normally the bases where you would see those aircraft. So, you know, there's, and particularly, you know, the people up in Queensland perhaps are not so sensitive to noise issues. But I'll tell you what, the people around Sydney certainly are. And if those things are noisy, there's already just some ridiculous noise abatement procedures that go on around Sydney Airport. I actually don't know how they pertain to Williamtown and Richmond there in Sydney, the two Air Force bases there. But if those aircraft are noisy, mind you, I guess the Hornets that are flying out, particularly out of Williamtown at the moment, they're pretty noisy anyway. So I guess the people hopefully would be used to that noise.
The main area of concern is actually Darwin, because although F-18s are not based there, they do stage out of the area. The current indications are that the JSF would be producing noise between 90 and 110 decibels as it crosses over the suburb of Ludmilla near Darwin Airport. And that's got a lot of people a bit concerned, because they have enough fun with F-18s coming in and out of there. Although the F-35 is not likely to come in as often, it is going to up the ante for jet noise on takeoff especially.
Well, I guess probably by the time we do episode 3000 of the Australia Desk, Grant, we should be able to talk about that, the way that development program's going.
Oh, I reckon, mate. It's going to be a while. I mean, we've got the F-35B having problems. The POMs have dropped it. There's starting to be rumours that maybe the Marines are going to change the way they deploy a lot of their aircraft, and they may not need the B anymore either. So if the B goes, well, all the work that was done to make the A and the C mostly compatible with the same airframe as the B has been for nothing. So, yeah, it's going to be really interesting to see where this one goes. But so far, for Australia's perspective, we're in the market to get a few. They should be arriving in 2014 if all goes well from here onwards. And we've got a lot of offset development going on here. There's a lot of companies making components and bits for the F-35.
Well, we'll leave defence there for this week. And I know we've talked about Qantas a lot, but let's talk about something a little different just for now. Qantas Freight, they're increasing their freight capacity, but I think not everybody at Qantas will be happy about the way they're doing it there. And Grant, I noticed on some pictures I'm looking at here on Plane Talking on the Crikey website, there's no giant white rat on the tail of that 767.
That's correct. They're setting up a 767-300F that'll be running freight across the Tasman between Australia and New Zealand starting around February of next year. They're currently using a 767-200F, but they're going to go to the 300F, take more freight across. But it's got a beautiful red tail, but it's not marred by any pieces of white. There's certainly no flying kangaroo on the tail of this Qantas 767-300F that'll be flying across the Tasman. When Ben Sandilands raised this issue with Qantas, the Qantas spokesperson said it's being flown by another party on behalf of Qantas, to which he noted that, of course, Cobham supplies air services for QantasLink, and their Q400s and 717s all have a white kangaroo on the tail. And let's also not forget Jet Connect flying out of New Zealand to do Trans-Tasman 737 flights carrying passengers. But they too are being flown by another party on behalf of Qantas. So, yeah, that argument doesn't quite hold water.
Well, you know, the way they're going there, it's a wonder they're just not making it Jetstar freighter. You know, they could put a Jetstar logo on the tail of that aircraft, it'd fit right in.
Yeah, well, you know, so long as you don't have to carry an extra baggage, and only 20 kilos a limit.
Imagine the freight charges on that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Qantas, of course, now we have touched a lot on the A380 incident, and it's interesting to note that, yes, as we reported last week, the 380s are back in the air in some capacity. One of the interesting issues that's come up out of the Trent 900 problems with the Rolls-Royce aircraft there is there's been a bit of speculation that perhaps Rolls-Royce already knew that there was a problem in some of the earlier build versions of this motor, of this engine rather, and were actually making some modifications as they go to newer ones. Well, they've got newer engines coming for Qantas's next couple of jets, but they've already found some faults with the newer engines as well.
That's correct. They've been doing assessments assessments on all the latest Trent 900s on all the aircraft that Qantas are going to be flying. And a brand new Trent 900 on one of the new A380s was investigated and discovered to have the same fault that is thought to have created the cataclysmic uncontained engine failure that impacted QF32 back in November. So, yeah, a bit of a worry there that brand new engines may still have the same problem.
Yeah, Grant, it's interesting to note that there's been no further news on the interim operating restrictions that Rolls-Royce have placed on Qantas that we spoke about last week with regard to limited thrust. So I guess it'll be quite some time before we see those aircraft operating from the east coast of Australia back across to the US, and Qantas will be very, very unhappy about that. That's one of their flagship routes, and they certainly like to sell tickets on the A380 on those routes at a premium price, I might tell you.
Oh, they do too, but interesting to note that as of next year, Singapore Airlines are going to be starting to fly their A380s out of LA, but they're doing it via Tokyo.
Good luck to them with that, Grant. I don't know that I'd want to, what is it, 7 or 8 hours from here to Tokyo? It's already a long enough flight as it is. I don't think I'd be going for that.
Yeah, well, I don't think they're going to get anyone from the Sydney-LA market, but people who are already in Asia stage through Tokyo and across to LA, not a bad deal.
Nice, and they're running Rolls-Royce on their A380s as well, I believe.
Yeah, well, it's pretty hard to change across to the Engine Alliance engines at this stage because it's a lot more than just pulling off a pod and popping a new one on, and as far as Qantas is concerned, it's not an option anyhow because they don't do a 72,000-pound thrust engine.
Well, that's about everything we have for you on this week's Australia Desk Report. We've got to finish this, Grant, and get cracking on episode 49 of Playing Crazy Down Under. We've got most of it put together. We've just got to record a few more finishing touches, and we can get that one out and start working on episode number 50. All right.
Ooh, the big 50.
50 for 50, folks. I just put it out there.
Yeah. Some of you know what that means.
Yes, well, and with that thought in mind, and Grant, gee whiz, it's not even midnight yet, so we might actually have some time to get that recording done. We'd better go. I'm Steve Vischer.
And I'm Grant McCarran.
Cheers, folks.
Boy, those guys are closing in on 50. That's pretty good. That's a big milestone.
You know, I never would have thought they were that old. They don't look that old. Yeah. But you know what's really funny is that I was thinking as they were talking about the A380, and
yeah,
it was amazing in Dubai. Emirates Airlines, of course, practically owns the Dubai International Airport. Mm. And in fact, the government and the airline, yeah, it's all tied up together anyway. But they're building a new terminal just for the A380s. And
wow, whole terminal.
It is probably the size. It's probably maybe 6 or 7 stories tall, and the length of 2 air carriers laid end to end.
Wow.
It's just unbelievable. And we saw so many A380s taxiing by per hour at one point. It was like being at the Airbus factory in Toulouse.
Yeah.
I mean, it was incredible.
And they have a pile of those things on order, too. There's a lot more to come.
Absolutely.
Yeah, very good. All right, here's Peter Johnson, our European correspondent with Across the Pond.
Today, I'm joined by Yvette Scott. Yvette runs the Airlines Angel website and is passionate about the passenger experience. Yvette has a particular interest in the areas of airline customer service and social media. Today we're going to talk about the British Airways Iberia merger and the American Airlines tie-up. So Yvette, welcome to Across the Pond.
Thank you for having me.
So BA and Iberia, now known by the snappy name the International Airline Group, have finally merged. What's your view about this joining together of these two old national carriers?
Initially, I was, I think, like everybody, a bit apprehensive because we didn't know at that stage if the British Airways or the Iberia brand would go, and in effect, we would lose our flag carrier. Obviously, since they've come out with the name International Airlines Group, I think people have become a bit more relaxed. Unfortunately, due to the current economic crisis, it is going to be seen more and more that airlines will have to merge, make stronger alliances in order to survive. And for me, I'd rather see British Airways survive than disappear from our skies.
So the merger, what do you think it will have, I suppose, on frontline services? I mean, with your experience of the customer service end of things, how do you think passengers are going to be affected by this?
until everything has, you know, settled down. I think crew will probably be a bit apprehensive, a bit unsure whether their jobs are secure. And I think that might have a slight knock-on effect to the levels of customer service.
Sure.
Which is, it's a real shame, because I think the crew should be really doing everything to say, like, I'm British Airways, I'm Iberia, I'm proud of it. Let's get on and keep our customers happy. Obviously, the strike has really dented the airline, and I know people that have flown during the strike period and they could see a big difference, a big dramatic drop in the levels of service on board.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, it only takes one bad experience for you to switch to the opposition.
Well, I certainly have found that very challenging. I mean, given the fact that the tie-up is apparently going to save the group around $500 million, is it unrealistic to think that a lot of that's not going to come from cutting service levels?
I think initially there will, as with any merger, there is going to be significant job losses. One figure that I did read was over 7,000 job losses.
Wow.
I'm expecting, obviously, sort of middle management positions will go, because obviously you won't need the two levels. There will be an impact on the crew, unfortunately. Again, till everything settles, you know, BA are in for a bumpy ride, as are Iberia.
Yeah. And now that they've agreed the alliance with American, what value do you think that American brings to IAG? What's that bring to the company on the transatlantic business, do you think?
Well, initially they've announced that, you know, for the likes of JFK Heathrow, we are going to see an hourly service. So it's going to be a shuttle service between the two airports, which will benefit passengers because they may not have to wait maybe 2-3 hours for the next service. It's just whether, you know, they're a diehard American Airlines passenger who ends up on a British Airways service or vice versa. And they, having flown all three airlines, they're all completely different in their levels of service.
Yeah. And can I just ask you what you think about the three different service levels?
My experience with Iberia was great. The crew were fantastic. They couldn't have done enough for you. I've known people that will just only book Iberia because of the route network that they have down to South America,
yeah,
which obviously BA will be able to take advantage of now.
And what do you think BA and Iberia get out of working so closely with American? Do they get a link into the American network, or how do you think that's going to benefit them?
Well, obviously, with the American rulings on foreign carriers within the United States, you know, this is a way for Iberia and British Airways to get their foot in the door, see more and more code share routes. I know British Airways have a limited number in the States at the moment, but we will see an increase on the number of code share destinations.
We know that Virgin Atlantic opposed the alliance between the IAG and American. What effect do you think that tie-up will have on Virgin's business?
Now, for Virgin, they are seriously going to be the underdog. You cannot really compete with the power of BA and American because they have such a strong network. And unfortunately, it's going to be like a monopoly. So the likes of Virgin and the newly merged United Continental, they will have to work so much harder to try and regain their market share of that route.
It's quite interesting, actually. I mean, I used to be a BA flyer across the Atlantic, but actually changed to fly Virgin because of the brand and because of the service levels. So it'd be interesting to see how that business develops.
I must admit, I'm a frequent Virgin flyer, and I've always been really impressed with the standards, no matter if I'm in economy, premium or the upper.
Yeah.
And it's just something and homely whenever I fly with Virgin.
Yeah, I agree. I really enjoy flying with them too. Can you just tell us a little bit about Airline Angels?
Yeah, certainly. It's a website that looks at the customer interaction. I'm from a very customer-focused background, and it's sort of showing that there is a good side to aviation, because unfortunately it's more the negative sides that do get out quite a lot. So it's just trying to get a balance and sort of show that there is some good out there.
Right. And how long have you been doing this for?
It's really within the last sort of 8 to 10 months that I've really been able to develop it.
And you seem to have quite an intuitive view on some of the airlines. How do you manage to get that? I suppose, how do you get that close to the airlines?
Well, most of the flights that I've taken are obviously off my own back. One airline I've got a bit of a bond struck up with, and they've been quite nice and have taken me to places like Berlin and Vienna, and just to really experience aircraft and their airline.
Well, Yvette, thank you very much for joining us. Where can our listeners find you on the internet?
Okay, on Twitter, I'm at Airlines Angel, and my website is airlinesangel.com.
Thank you very much for joining us today, Yvette.
Thank you. It's been my pleasure.
You know, we need to get Peter on the podcast. Maybe we should sign him up to be a guest in January.
I'm sorry. Peter who?
Peter.
Oh, that guy. Boy, I'll tell you, he and I were talking last week while I was on the trip because the weather in Britain was terrible.
Yeah, a lot of snow, right?
It was a mess. I mean, going through Heathrow last week was just, I couldn't have picked a worse week to try to go through there. I mean, ice, snow, and they're just not ready for that over there.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think that'd be a lot of fun. We ought to get him on. He does talk a little funny, so, I mean, we have to be ready for that, but.
Yeah, but we're used to that. I mean, after Grant and Steve,
you're probably right.
We got some great listener mail again this past week. First one comes from Jarrett. And you'll recall that we read Jarrett's email last week, and he was describing how many aviators he has in his family. And in doing that, he mentioned that his uncle flew A320s for FedEx, and Dan called him out on it and said
They don't have A320s.
FedEx doesn't have any A320s. And so Jarrett wrote back and said, Dan was right. FedEx doesn't have any A320s. He says, I called my uncle, and he said that he is a captain on an A300-600 or an A310. He can fly either. So can't wait for episode 127. Thanks. I'm glad we got that cleared up with Jarrett's uncle. We also got an interesting link from Steven, who works for JetBlue. The JetBlue employees have, or at least several of them, have put together a safety video called Safety is Mandatory. Steven sends along a link. Actually, Steven features prominently in this little video, so we'll put a link.
I love this video.
Isn't it great?
I just loved it. I really did.
We're in the bathroom, reading on the bag tag, organizing bag cards, clearing out the bag jam, stretching out our bad bags to avoid back pain, bending at the knees to avoid a lower back strain. Safety is mandatory, it's another value of our company.
Yeah, basically, the employees are discussing safety aspects of different jobs on the ramp and in the baggage area and so forth. And they have flip cards that they use to kind of follow the script as it goes along. And it's really well done, very nicely done. Kind of amazing for, an employee effort as opposed to something, more professional. It really comes across real well. So we'll put a link in the show notes. Be sure you see that. We also got a voicemail from Ian.
Good afternoon, Airplane Geeks. This is Ian Kershaw calling from Calgary, Alberta, YYC. It's Thursday, December the 9th at 12:15, just enjoying episode 126. Just a few things. Mentioning voice use of cell phones on flights. Does that mean we're going to have to try and manage Skype users when they're on broadband with their laptops? Could be very interesting. I'm a relocated Brit, been here in Canada for some 20 years. It's a cool, beautiful day, but at minus 12 Celsius right now from minus 18 this morning, the one thing we don't have is a heat haze when taking pictures, so everything has its benefits. Calgary's a pretty boring airport for the most part, but amidst the regular commercials, we do get some interesting movements. We've had Twin Otter in from Libya just recently. Viking are producing new build Twin Otters. And Ken Borak, who's the largest fleet of Twin Otters in the world, he's also got a bunch of DCT turbos that keep coming in and out. On the tanker front, well, the RAS still bring in their Tornadoes every summer and service them with the venerable VC-10. Now, that is a tanker worth seeing. And long may they continue to fly. So just wishing you well. I thoroughly enjoy the show, and maybe we could even do a quarterly 2-minute spot on what happens to the north of you folks in the States. So this is Ian Kershaw, yyce3.ca/wordpress. Once again, I thoroughly enjoy listening to you guys, the banter and the meat in the conversations. Bye now.
Well, thanks to Ian for that. You know, it's interesting, Rob, when he mentions, you know, using Skype as a way around a cell phone restriction on, you know, in-flight connectivity. I guess there's almost always a way to around any kind of rule that you have.
Well, you know, it's funny. I think I remember talking about this once. Maybe it was with Dan I was talking about. And I think it was either with Dan or maybe it was Mary Kirby or somebody. Mm. But I think they told me that Skype is somehow disconnected.
Maybe it's blocked.
Try to connect through any of the Wi-Fi on the airplanes. And when we were in Dubai, it was an interesting story that just popped up that Airbus had approved a GSM system for its business jet version of the A320, if you can imagine an A320 as a corporate airplane,
yeah.
So that people could use their cell phones in there. And the room I was working in, I wrote this and I groaned, and everybody said, "Oh my God, what's the matter?" And I said, "I can see it coming." Wow. I mean, if they can do it on an A320 that's a corporate airplane, I can see this opportunity to use the cell phone coming on a regular airplane,
yeah.
and I won't be able to get earplugs big enough.
I know. I just dread it. I just dread it.
I'll have to go out and buy some Bose headsets.
That's it. We also got a voicemail from Trevor. Trevor's from the Desert Pilot podcast, which is a great flying podcast. If you haven't heard that, check that out. Here's Trevor's message.
Hey, Airplane Geeks. This is Trevor Smith from DesertPilot.com. Hey, I was just calling about, actually, to David. I heard on Aero News that mentioned about the Navy released a report saying that, oh, by the way, that the engine for the F-35 is too big to fit on any of their transport planes and on any of their transport ships to get to their carriers. I was wondering if you could elaborate a little bit on that. I don't know if Aero News was just giving us a lot of BS or if you have read anything about that. And that'll be it. Also, Dan, I will definitely call on your show. Have a good night. Bye.
David, what do you think about that?
Well, we're going to have to wait till next week, aren't we?
Yeah, we're going to have to wait till next week. I wasn't quite sure if I understood that, though, that the engine is too big to fit on an airplane to get it to the carrier.
I looked up the Aero News article. It's on Aero. That's aero-news.net. I found it there. They referenced a Navy Times article, which I also found, and I'll put the links in the show notes. What they seem to be saying, it wasn't the dimensions of the engine that wouldn't fit through the door so much as it was the storage container or the shipping container. I'm a little confused by it. I'm going to do some more research on this, and again, maybe David can help as well. The F-35 engine, which is currently the F-135, it's 220 inches in length, but the maximum diameter is 51 inches. The F-22, which is powered by the F-119 engine, the specs aren't available. They don't publish those. But if you look at a F-100 engine, which powers the F-15 and F-16, it's a little bit shorter, 191 inches. Maximum diameter is a little bit shorter, too, a little bit smaller, too. That's 46.5 inches compared to 51 inches for the F-35 engine. So, I mean, they're all kind of roughly in the same size category. What I don't know is if there's some different kind of shipping container for the F-35 engine that
I have a feeling this is one of those stories that someone wrote that kind of thought we'd understand what they were talking about, and I don't think we did.
Yeah. 'Cause
it just doesn't make any sense to me. But
so we'll try to do some research and see if we can answer Trevor's question, because it's a good question.
Hopefully if David shows up next week,
he better show up.
Yeah, I mean, David, where are you?
I know, huh?
Anyway.
We got a couple of other emails. Just quickly, David, not our David, wrote saying, thanks for another interesting show. After listening to David's book review, it suddenly hit me what a small world we live in. I listened to that section while in my office, built on the site, BAE Hatfield Airfield, now a business park, where a lot of comet work was done. Hatfield Town signs actually say home of the comet on them. Also says, over the years, I watched the last few flights take off and land and see the airfield used in Saving Private Ryan and Band of Brothers for HBO. Sadly, all that is left now is the main hangar and tower and a few street names. He also writes, I also followed David Vanderhoof's tweets and noticed he was near Paulsboro, New Jersey recently, which is where my work buddy's U.S. relatives live. Small world. And that was from Dave. Got an email from Carlos. He writes, hello to all of us. It's Carlos from Earsham in Suffolk in the United Kingdom. Just got to say thanks, guys, for producing a really great show that, even though I am a civil aviation enthusiast, is making me enjoy military. David now as well as GA. Just a few things I'll tell you to ask you, if I may. Next year, all being well, I'm having a tour of the air base at Breeze Norton near Oxford in the UK to view to view the Lockheed TriStar L-1011s they have there, as these are a huge passion of mine, and as they are being phased out around the world now, sadly. And we'll probably record an interview with the guys there. If you would like me to send it in to you, it would be great if David could do a small history segment on the TriStar. So definitely, Carlos, if you know you have some great conversations with some of those guys, try to capture that and send in some audio. We'd be glad to take a look at that, see if we can play that on the show. Carlos also asked about the Please Remove Your Shoes video that we covered on a previous episode, and he's trying to get a copy of it in the UK, so I'm going to try to find out if they have a version that works with European DVD players, because the standard is different and they're not interchangeable. And finally, Carlos is coming to visit his girlfriend next year, coming to visit in the U.S., and he's looking to see if there are any good museums that show a lot of passenger aircraft. Dan responded back and suggested the Smithsonian Museum in Washington, or the Udvar-Hazy portion of that over at Dulles Airport. But if any of our listeners have any other great suggestions for Carlos, please send those in.
Go out to Mojave, where the Boneyard is. I mean, that's
great.
That's actually a site that, it's very sad if you're an airplane geek, but yeah. I mean, it's just amazing the kinds of airframes you'll see out there.
Yeah, that's definitely a must visit.
Of course, he didn't tell us where his girlfriend lived, did he?
No, he didn't. And the U.S. is a pretty big country.
He probably doesn't trust us.
Yeah, he wouldn't want to give us that information.
Yeah. Okay.
I think that's about it for the listener mail. Thank you for listening to the Airplane Geeks podcast. Our guest this episode was Captain Steve Fulton. He's a former Alaska Airlines pilot. Now he's a technical fellow with GE Aviation. He's co-founder of Navarus, which you can find at www.naverus.com, which is now a GE business. That's GE PBN Services. We'd also like to thank Steve Vischer and Grant McCarron from the Plane Crazy Down Under podcast for their Australia Desk report, and also Peter Johnson for his Across the Pond segment. We'll look forward to having David Vanderhoof back with us next week. Hopefully he'll have his issues resolved. Meantime, Rob Mark, tell folks where they can find you online.
Well, people probably don't know that I'm a jolly fellow. But
you're not in a red suit, are you?
It doesn't count for a whole lot. But anyway, they can find us at jetwine.com and also on Twitter at jetwine. See y'all next week.
Excellent. And Dan Webb, where do people find you online?
Well, to find me, first need to believe in a little bit of Christmas magic.
Aw.
God, I smell a unicorn joke coming up.
I wasn't going there. Anyway, to find my blog, thingsinthesky.com, if you want to tweet me, Dan Webbage. Though tweets might be a little sparse this week. I'm in the midst of finals, so I'm going to go in a cave somewhere.
Yeah, stay off of Twitter and study your books. And I'm Max Flight. You can find me at 30,000feet.com or on Twitter as Max Flight. Be sure to see airplanegeeks.com for show notes, links, t-shirts, listener comments, and probably some other stuff. You can follow us on Twitter and Facebook as Airplane Geeks. And we're also on Stitcher.com, where you can stream us to your mobile phone. If you'd like to send us email, we're at thegeeks@airplanegeeks.com. If you'd like to leave us voicemail, we have our listener line.
And if you want to call the Airplane Geeks, you can dial 361-GEEKS-01.
Thank you, Vinay. And if you'd really like to help us out, please be sure to tell your friends about the Airplane Geeks podcast. All right.
And can I just add one quick note?
Sure.
In there?
Yeah.
I forgot to say thank you to Binet for completely taking over the show last week while I was not here. And the fact that people said that she did an excellent job,
she did,
didn't bother me at all.
I'm sure.
Because I'm a very strong person and very secure. And
you're not threatened by women.
I'm not threatened at all. But I was also 10,000 miles away, so what could I do?
Yeah.
Thank you, Binet.
Be sure to join us again next week as we talk aviation on the Airplane Geeks podcast. Bye, everybody.
See you
later. Thanks for listening.
Did you bring your wife a nice gift?
Yes. Yes. Me.
Oh, yeah. She got to see you come home.
It has a long flight, I have to tell you. It was.
Wait. Did you at least get your daughter a gift or something? Or just no?
You know, I was really bad about gift buying while I was over there because it's just the whole area is just focused on shopping. And I don't know. I just didn't feel like shopping.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm sure you could use that excuse at Christmas, and everyone will understand.
Well, I already did my Christmas shopping. That probably had something else to do with it, too.
Yeah, good thing.
We won't talk about the fun time I had getting over there and getting back. That's an airport or an airline alliance issue, but we'll save that for another time.
Okay.
You go skiing there, Rob?
No, actually, I wish I had. I just didn't have a chance to do that. I mean, I really wanted to go to the mall to go skiing. And
that's one of those indoor ski slopes?
No. It's outside.
No, it's indoors. It's inside the shopping mall there.
No, it's outside.
No, it's outside. How could it be outside? It's not outside.
Yeah, sure.
It's too hot.
No, it's inside for sure.
You're pulling our leg.
Oh, man. I almost had him going there.
All right.
In their airline.
Sorry, Yvette. The line dropped out then. Can you just say that last sentence again?
Oh, sorry. What was I saying?
I don't know because you dropped out.
I actually just have one real quickie because I went up on the site as we were sitting here looking. And it's that Air China video to Runway 5 at Linji. Is that the one you were talking about?
Yeah, Linji is how they pronounce it.
It won't work.
Oh, really?
It won't run.
That's disappointing. It's on YouTube.
It's on YouTube too?
Yep.
Okay.
Just go to YouTube site and bang in Linji RMP or something like that, and you'll have it.
Cool. All right.
And we'll put links in the show notes to these.
And we'll work on our site and understand what's going on. I'll have that fixed.
It's probably Rob.
Probably.
Yeah, you don't have to do anything, Steve. Don't worry.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
We'll confirm after this.
Confident that day. There's some track record here, Rob. Tell me.
Yeah, I know. I mean, only people who qualify for Social
Security as well. So, I don't know. Maybe there's a message here.
Only people that qualify for Social Security have trouble with it. So.
Well, then I guess I don't have to worry.
No, you could have taken it early. Or no, is that 62 now?
God.
Whatever, I'm sorry.